This recording, Devon History 2, is copyright the International Dialect of English Archive.
Well, this is a very long journey, actually. If you start from the beginning, I was born in Plymouth, or in Devonport, as it was then known, and brought up in a very working-class family, and it wasn't long before the war came. And that was a terrible time, because my school friends were killed, the home I lived in was bombed, and all in all, it is not full of happy memories, except that I was shipped off to friends or relations in Paignton, which is a holiday town, if you like, and I stayed there for a month or two. I'd already taken the what is now the 11 plus, but at the time I took it when I was, I think, 9 or 10, known as the scholarship. Now came 11th out of the whole of Plymouth, which meant that I could go to just about any school. My parents went for Devonport High School, where I went to the local grammar school. And I was evacuated to Penzance. So this was, I didn't realise it at the time, but that was actually very traumatic for me, because I was very much a mummy's boy, and I just had a good time. I did no studying. I enjoyed myself at the hostel that I stayed at, which was immediately opposite St Michael's Mount, a place called Marazine, where they make the best Cornish pasties that I know. And when I came back, I took my trick, but I broke my ankle at the time and just couldn't make it. So my father said, "You will go in the local dockyard if you pass the dockyard examination," which I did. And I ended up as a shipwright, not knowing what the heck a shipwright was. Anyway, after I would finish my apprenticeship, I went into the Air Force for 2 years conscription. And whilst I was in there, I realised I wasn't the numbskull I thought I was. And I eventually left the Air Force, and when I came out, decided that it's time I started doing some work. I can remember to this day standing in the tiller flat of the HMS, I think it was the Wizard, and looking up in the stars in the sky and thinking, this isn't how you're going to finish your life. And I started to study, and I eventually became a fellow of the Royal Institute of Naval Architects, and by studying and passing the various exams that I needed to. And I became a draftsman, and I worked as a draftsman for a time, but not satisfied with that, I then opted to go to South Africa. Now, there's a long story attached to that. My grandfather was South African. He was a child of 1820 settlers. My mother instilled on me in her life that her wish to be reunited with her family, who to a large extent were Afrikaans speaking, believe it or not. And I eventually came to the dockyard, and in the first year or so, I was very happy indeed. I was sponsored by a gentleman by the name of Eric Hebden, and he decided that it would be a good idea if we both joined the Navy, and then he would, look after me and train me into perhaps following in his own shoes. Unfortunately, this wasn't to happen, because they wouldn't give him the post that he wanted, they wouldn't give him the rank he wanted or he desired, and he left, which left me high and dry. No training whatsoever. I was told to get into uniform, and that was it. Well, obviously, I was very unhappy and didn't know what the heck to do. I had nobody to lean on. I had no one to turn to. I didn't know what to do, and the ultimate, my mother and father arrived from England and wanted somewhere to stay, so they stayed with me, and eventually I was hoping to see my grandfather. I'd never seen any of my grandparents, and I wasn't allowed to have any leave until I'd worked for them for 12 months. And darn me if my grandfather didn't die before I even got a chance to see him. So the whole purpose of the business was gone. But in the meantime, I was left high and dry with the Navy, and unfortunately fell out with an admiral who had no qualifications, although he was eventually made a professional engineer, and he'd never passed any examinations other than an NCC2, and I'd been teaching him the equivalent of a higher grade than that in UK. So I don't know if he didn't like me or whether I was a threat to him, as was suggested to me by Professor Hutting at Stellenbosch University, and I just suffered the position of being eventually reverting to civilian life, but always occupying a position of authority. For instance, I was the planning manager, I was the staff officer A's and A's, I held superior positions but never paid for them, always as in an acting position. So I went to my hobby, which happened to be magic and puppeteering, where I could get some kind of fulfillment because I couldn't get it anywhere else. And I certainly got it in that area, having eventually going to England to represent South Africa as a puppeteer with the International Brotherhood of Magicians. And so I got some kind of recompense. Eventually, though, it was almost inevitable, I resigned. And then I joined a company, Marion Roberts. And the last 10 years of my life, I worked for them very successfully as a professional engineer, and I moved factories from England to South Africa, from France to South Africa, and I was much respected, and I got fulfillment, which is what I was looking for. I got divorced from the first wife. My second wife I spent a very interesting time with, because she was a theatre critic, and I lost myself in the theatricals and in work. Was very successful in that area. And finally, in engineering, moving these factories around. And I'll always be very grateful to Marion Roberts for taking what was a lame duck almost, and boosting me and giving me the pension which I've got today, thank goodness. As soon as I resigned, I resigned from the Navy, but I didn't resign from Marion Roberts. I left them with flags waving and everything else, and I immediately walked from my office into KPAB, which was. And I became their puppet master for 3 years. I toured with Packhoffs. I toured with KPAB, and I worked. I acted in the Great Junction George, and my hobby became my work place for the time being. And then my dear wife died of the breast cancer. 6 months after that, I met another lady, and we got together, and she was my lifelong partner. And damn me if she didn't die in Athens when we were on a Mediterranean cruise. But she was a wonderful lady, and I have a wonderful relationship with her children, my surrogate sons and daughters. I still have relationship with my stepchildren. I'm a sort of an eternal grandfather. Now I'm getting older, and I'm getting lonely, but I worked with a concert party for some time towards the end of my career, and I'm going back with them. They're commemorating their 25 years, and I've had a wonderful life, actually. I'm surrounded by my puppets and magic and good food and good wine, good drink, good liquor, and I have a lot of friends. So I'm very grateful for my own daughter, who's dying of breast cancer and is having chemo. My stepdaughter, whose husband is suffering from terrible trouble with his gallbladder. That's it. I'm just waiting to go myself and join my spiritual level on the other side. That's about it. Plymouth gin. It's the best gin you can get. And I haven't seen it since I left Plymouth. It's made in Plymouth. It's a name. The distillery I'm darned if I can remember what it is now, but it's a monkish establishment, let me put it that way. And a gin was always supplied to ships like Sir Francis Drake and so on, because it has a very high alcohol content, which is sufficient for setting off the gunpowder. So it's about 67% or some ridiculous figure, and it's very good for setting off gunpowder. It's also very good for setting off people, actually. And as you can probably tell, I've had a couple. So there we are. It's a concoction made with slow berries and distilled in Plymouth. And I found it just this year. It's the first time I found it, and I hate to tell you, it's 50 rand a bottle, but it brings back so many memories, and it's nothing like. There's no gin like Plymouth gin. It has its own flavour. It's not like any other gin whatsoever. And it was always, when I was working for the Admiralty, if you were ever invited to a wardroom and you were invited to have a drink, it was always the midshipman who invited you. You always asked for a pink gin because it was the cheapest one you could get, and it didn't cost them too much. Sure, now, and what are you after thinking that I can do it, but where I come from with socks like this, sure, how are you? And you're looking pretty, very animal down there, darling, eh? What are you doing then? Where are we going? Are you going town or are you? Of course, you can do a bit of Irish as well, sure, and it'll be the leprechauns that'll be doing a thing or two, I'm sure. And how are you, Mrs. Murphy? Are you all right? Ah, hey. And then there's always the Welsh accent, which is, indeed to goodness, and have you been singing at the chapel today? You'll be singing tomorrow, will you? Oh, I'll be coming down to see you a bit, yes.